introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Jody Hauer. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. And I'm going to talk about this report that we released earlier this year on Green Acres and the two farmland preservation programs. I'm going to start by just summarizing what we found, and then I'll get into a bit more detail on each of the programs. Overall, we found for the Green Acres program that it does effectively reduce taxes for people who are enrolled in the program, but it doesn't help everyone who could be eligible, and I'll get back to that point. We think it's unclear whether the program's goals include benefiting certain people and certain types of land that currently are eligible for the program. The program has some eligibility criteria that are unworkable and cause some problems. And the Green Acres program has not been implemented consistently around the state. Regarding the two programs in the state for preserving farmland, we found that the programs can help state development and in some cases stage the pace of development, but overall we concluded that they are not sufficient to preserve farmland for the long term. And I will come back to that point, but I'm going to start with more detail on the Green Acres program first. Now, the Green Acres program applies only to farmland where the values have increased due to non-agricultural factors, things like development pressures that push up the price of the land. And to be eligible, the owner has to meet certain requirements. There are ownership criteria. There's a requirement that the land produce a certain amount of income each year. And the land has to be classified as agricultural. It has to be at least 10 acres in size or be a nursery or greenhouse. And it has to be primarily devoted to agricultural use. Now, overall, we found that the Green Acres program does effectively equalize property taxes for the people who are enrolled in the program. And it does this by significantly reducing the value of that land for taxing purposes. Green Acres land is valued according to how it's used for agricultural purposes, not according to how the assessor might value it for its highest and best use, which is an assessor's typical practice. And the difference between those two can be quite large. One example, in 2007, the average value for an acre of land, farmland, in the four fast-growing counties that are just immediately north of the Twin Cities metropolitan area, was at $6,500 per acre. Now, by contrast, the Green Acres program reduced the value of that acre to an average $1,900. That's more than a threefold difference in the reduction of the value of that land. Now, due to those lower taxable values, the participants are paying fewer taxes. We estimated that last year, in 2007, the program reduced the participants' property taxes by $35 million statewide. Beyond those tax breaks, owners of Green Acres land pay less they're not subject to special assessments. Special assessments might be charged for water or sewer systems, but any of those public improvements, the special assessments for Green Acres participants, those are deferred until the owner sells the land. And when that land is sold, the owner is responsible to pay back 3 years' worth of the tax break that he or she received, but any tax break for years prior to the immediate past 3 years represents a permanent break for that landowner. Now, as I said, we think the program is effective overall at equalizing taxes, but it does have some limits. First of all, the program has not been implemented statewide. 35 counties do not have land enrolled in the Green Acres program, even though we learned from county assessors in several of those counties that non-agricultural factors had increased the value of farmland in at least some parts of their county. Now, this map shows the percentage of land, farmland acres in each township that's enrolled in the Green Acres program. The counties in white have no land enrolled in the program. The darkest areas of green represent the greatest concentrations of Green Acres enrollment. Second, we think that the program's effectiveness on tax equalization is limited because certain landowners simply decide against applying. They're eligible in every way. They meet all the eligibility requirements, but they don't apply. And that's for any number of reasons. Some simply mistrust government programs. They just don't want to be involved, so they steer away from them. Others might be in a position where they're planning to soon sell their land and they don't think it's worth it. And third, we think that not all landowners may be aware of the program in each of the counties. We interviewed the county assessors in 48 of the counties with the program, and for 5 of those counties, we saw that they had relatively low amounts of land enrolled in the program, but the counties only provided information on the Green Acres program at the request of the landowner. And by contrast, in most other counties, the county assessor will send mailings or in other way, some other way, provide information about the program to the potentially eligible participants. Now, besides tax equalization, we looked at how the program, if it had an effect on preserving farmland. The statutes do not explicitly say that one of the program's goals is to preserve farmland. But a lot of people think that the program was set up for that purpose. So we went as a part of our analysis and looked at, well, how well does it do that? We concluded that the program does not effectively preserve farmland for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's no long-term commitment by the owner to the land. The program's not restricted to regions that are zoned for long-term agricultural use. So owners who are part of the program can divide their land and sell it at any time. The amount of the tax benefit provided by the program is small when you compare it to the rapid rise in farmland values over time. Again, thinking about that, four counties, fast-growing counties in the area just north of the metropolitan region, an 80-acre farm there back in 1993 was valued at $62,000. Last year, that was over $520,000 for that 80-acre farm. Now, the average tax benefit for that farm that was a part of the Green Acres program was only $1,350 last year, and that benefit would have been slightly less in the preceding years. So you can see that the value of that land is far greater than the amount of the tax benefit from the Green Acres program. And finally, we saw that the program's effect on preserving farmland is tenuous because it's not targeted to high-quality land. It could be land that is pretty poor quality, or it could be high-prime farmland, but the program doesn't differentiate between the two. And the program is not targeted to land that's at risk of soon being developed either. We saw that there are also controversies over who receives the Green Acres benefit. And we concluded that it's unclear whether the goals of the program include benefiting certain landowners who currently are eligible. For instance, people who are not farmers can still qualify for the Green Acres benefit. Landowners can benefit from the program even when most of their land is not in agricultural production. Lands that have values increasing due to recreational purposes, like hunting, also qualify for the program. And another source of some controversy is small farms, 10 or 15 acres or so, where some assessors have found it problematic to determine whether or not those are simply large residential properties or whether they are indeed primarily devoted to agricultural uses. So it's important to realize that all these cases that I noted here are eligible for the benefit under current law. So we think it's important for the legislature to review who should be eligible and what types of land should be eligible for the program for two main reasons. First of all, the benefits are sizable. They can be such that they would reduce a property owner's tax bill by one-tenth or one-half. It varies depending on where they're located in the state. But there are significant reductions in the property taxes as a result of the program. And secondly, the tax relief for those owners that do participate in the program are largely paid for by shifting that tax burden from the participating landowners to those in the community who are not enrolled in the program. We concluded that there are some problems with the eligibility criteria for the Green Acres program. I mentioned earlier that there's this minimum income that the land must produce each year. There are several problems with that income criteria. And first of all, the threshold was set back in 1969, and that income threshold hasn't been adjusted to be better aligned with land rent since that point. Beyond that, many landowners balk at having to provide what they consider to be their private financial information to the assessor. They don't like handing that over. And so some of them are facing a situation where they don't have information that they can use to verify whatever information is provided on the application. Assessors don't have access to income tax data. That's classified information. It's private information. So they really don't have a good means for verifying the data on the application. Another problem has arisen over how assessors classify land as agricultural. Now, Minnesota statutes, of course, do define types of property that can be defined as agricultural for classification purposes. So there are products in statute like grains or livestock, bees and apiary products, all of which can be defined as agricultural for classification purposes. But the statutes don't specify how much of those items is necessary to meet the qualification standards. So assessors face situations where it's unclear how many acres of how many beehives are necessary to qualify for that agricultural classification. There's a similar problem with statutory language regarding green acres land that is primarily devoted to agricultural use, because statutes don't define what is primarily agricultural. And we also found that implementing the Green Acres program has varied around the state. And we found that to happen in several areas. First of all, counties are not uniform in whether or not they verify applicants' agricultural income. Second, there's variation in how they define land as primarily agricultural. Third, there was variation in how counties treated parcels that have more than one owner. Fourth, in about half of the counties, the assessors might have a property where a portion of that parcel is residential, but the remaining portion of that parcel is classified as agricultural. But in some of those counties where that practice is followed, that portion that is classified as agricultural can qualify for green acres, but in other counties, that's disallowed. And finally, we saw that county assessors vary in how they inform landowners about the program. Now, many of the problems that I've talked about here were apparent before our evaluation was concluded, and in October of last year, the Department of Revenue issued a bulletin on the Green Acres program to help implement it in a more of a consistently statewide basis. In that bulletin, the department describes the difficulties that assessors face in trying to set that low agricultural use value for property that's in the program. And the department believes that there are very few farmland sales left around the state that are purely for agricultural uses that could be used to help set that lower value. So in this bulletin, the department has proposed a new method for setting that low agricultural use value for land in the program. And we think that the method proposed by the department works reasonably well, not perfect, but works reasonably well for most tillable acres around the state. We think, though, it's far less useful for the non-tillable acres. The non-tillable land essentially will have a single statewide percentage that would be applied wherever the land is in the county, so that the non-tillable land would be valued at half of the agricultural value of the tillable land. The problem with that is it's unrealistic. It doesn't reflect what's really going on in several counties, especially some in like North Central Minnesota, where the value of the non-tillable acres is very close to the agricultural value of those tillable acres. So we think that method has some problems. The bulletin does also provide guidance for assessors from the department, and that guidance is an attempt to help make it more consistently implemented more consistently around the state, and we think that's valuable. We think that guidance is good. We do suggest a couple of other subjects where we think additional guidance might also be helpful. Before the Green Acres program, we recommend that the legislature, first of all, clarify in statute who and what types of land really ought to benefit from the Green Acres program. We believe the legislature should change the Green Acres law by eliminating that income criterion and instead adding more specificity in the statute to defining what should qualify as agricultural when assessors classify land as agricultural, and also adding specificity in determining what is primarily agricultural, as is stated in the Green Acres statute. And we think that this kind of an approach would better focus the program on how the land is used and not worry as much about who happens to own the land. Beyond that, we think that the Department of Revenue should continue its efforts to make the program more consistent from county to county. We do think it should make some changes to its approach, including modifying its method for valuing those non-tillable acres of the Green Acres program. I'm going to move on now, Madam Chair and members, to the two farmland preservation programs. As I mentioned at the start, Minnesota has two such programs. One is for the seven-county metropolitan area. The second is designed for all counties in greater Minnesota. Now, the benefits of the two programs are similar, but there is one very important difference. The land that's enrolled in the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserve Program enjoys the that lower tax value, similar to that in the Green Acres program. The land is valued at that low agricultural use value instead of the higher highest and best use value. However, that same benefit is not available to the farmland enrolled in the Greater Minnesota Farmland Preservation Program. For both programs, participants receive a property tax credit. It's equivalent to about $1.50 per acre, and each participant receives that tax credit on his or her property tax bill each year. Public improvements like water and sewer systems are not allowed within agricultural preserves. The owners there typically do not have to pay any special assessments even when such public improvements are put in the vicinity of their property. Cities and towns are prohibited from passing any ordinance that would unduly restrict normal farm practices or farm structures. And cities may not annex agricultural preserve land that happens to be located in a township unless it meets very certain and specific conditions that are stated in law. Now, regarding the farmland preservation programs, we found that the programs can help to shape the development in an area, or it can help to slow the pace of development in a certain area. Many of the local officials that we spoke to as a part of this evaluation told us they thought that these farmland preservation programs were helpful to them. They helped them support their own local land use policies regarding agricultural properties. They particularly enjoyed the benefits from the programs in the sense that the programs help to prevent some of that scattered site development that might otherwise lead to land use conflicts when farmers are in a certain area and then others come in and build nearby, only to find that later they don't like the noise or the dust or the smell of the farming operations. And of course, that creates land use problems that can be avoided, and in part from the use of these programs. At the same time, though, we concluded that these farmland preservation programs are not effective at preserving farmland for the long term. And that's for a couple of reasons. First, we just have the economic forces and the market conditions that are out there that have made farmland around the state extremely valuable. The benefits of the program can be significant for an individual landowner, but when compared with the increase in the farmland values, the benefit is quite small. One example that I'd like to point out is just looking at the increase in the value of land over the last 10 years. In the metropolitan area, a single acre of farmland on the average increased $8,100. And in Greater Minnesota, the average increase was $1,400. So when you have those kind of high increases in land prices, the incentive that's part of the program to keep the land in agricultural production is just far less than it might otherwise be. Now, another factor that limits the effectiveness of these farmland preservation programs is the low and the declining enrollment in the program. On this table, you see that of the 9 counties that have land enrolled in the farmland preservation programs, only one, and that's Carver County, has more than half of its farmland enrolled in an ag land preservation program. All 9 of the counties have lost enrolled land since the late 1990s when enrollment peaked. One example is Scott County. At this point, as of 2007, only 6% of its farmland acres are in the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserves Program, and it lost 15% of its enrollment since 1998. In the Greater Minnesota Program, the low number of governments participating in the program has limited its usefulness there. Only 3 counties have ever had land in only 3 counties in Greater Minnesota have ever had land enrolled in the Farmland Preservation Program there. And among those, only one, and that's Waseca County, has ever had more than a third of its farmland acres enrolled in the program. And finally, we think that the effectiveness of the program is limited because of the relative ease with which participants can leave the program. The program does require the landowner to have on his land deed, a covenant, a restrictive covenant that requires the owner to keep the land in agricultural production for a minimum of 8 years. But after the landowner files notice that he no longer wants to participate in the program and he reaches that 8-year point, he can leave the program without incurring any penalty. Beyond the questions on how effective the program was, we found that nobody at the state level or the local level has enforcement authority over the Farmland Preservation Program. The law contains no sanctions for noncompliance. And we learned of a small number of cases where the land in an agricultural preserve was developed before that 8-year period ended, or before the landowner even filed a notice that he or she wanted to have the land expire, have the covenant expire. And finally, we looked at the revenues that are raised through these farmland preservation programs. The counties that participate have authority to charge $5 fees for any deed or mortgage that they register or record in their county. And the county's share of those revenues goes into what's called a conservation account. Now, counties use that money to reimburse local governments for the tax credit that they pay. That $1.50 per acre tax credit, I said, is available for any owner of land in the program. Beyond that, if there is any money left over after reimbursing those tax credits, then the counties are eligible to use that money for other purposes that are specified in law. And those purposes are farmland preservation and conservation planning and prevention of soil erosion. So we looked at how counties have spent those dollars, those excess dollars, over the last 5 years. And we found that for the most part, those dollars are used to help fund the water and soil conservation districts. And those districts are using those dollars on soil conservation and activities to help prevent erosion, clearly within the purpose of the law. We did, though, find a small number of projects that were, in our opinion, only loosely connected to what the law would allow. One example is the Master Gardener Program. By themselves, of course, they're very good programs, but it's questionable as to whether they could be interpreted to fall within what the law allows. We think that those very few projects that are loosely tied to the purposes in law were approved because the language in law is very broad and can be interpreted quite broadly. So we think as a result of our findings on the farmland preservation programs that the legislature, if Minnesota wishes to preserve farmland for the long term, the legislature should consider supplementing what existing programs are out there and using additional strategies, things like land acquisition programs or other programs that would actually achieve long-term preservation of the farmland. Now, the downside to that is that all these alternatives are costly. None of them will come cheap. So if the legislature believes this is an important purpose and does decide it wants additional programs, it has to realize that it's going to come with a high cost. We also recommend that the legislature improve the existing programs by specifying in law who does have the authority to enforce them, and by adding some sanctions, some penalties for noncompliance. And then finally, we suggest that the legislature determine that whether the spending of those $5 fee revenues that I spoke about briefly, whether spending them on projects other than farmland preservation or other than soil conservation is unacceptable. If it is unacceptable, then the legislature has to change the statutory language to specify which activities should be unallowable. So with that, Madam Chair, that's the conclusion of my formal remarks. I'll be glad to answer questions anyone may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
We all like Green Acres.
Yes, we do. I'm going to ask my question first. The Green Acres is actually in every county, but some of them aren't being used. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think to be more precise, there are 35 counties where the program has not been implemented, and in some of them, at least 8 of them, there we've been told that farmland values have increased due to non-agricultural factors, which suggests that the program could have been implemented in those counties, in at least those counties.
Okay. Representative Bowes?
My question is really along the same line. A lot of the counties, when I look at your map, that that are white on your map have a, you know, a very high percentage of agricultural land in it. And so does this program not work if there isn't a big variation in the price of land? Is that why those counties are not using it, or is it they just haven't gotten around to using it, which would surprise me considering so much of those are in agriculture parts of the state?
Madam Chair, Representative, the answer is really a mix. You're right, and in some of those counties that are in white on that map, they really probably should have already implemented the program, but in others of those counties, there may not be much in the way of land that has increased in price due to non-agricultural factors, development pressures, or the hunting or other recreational uses that have driven up the price of farmland in some other counties. So unless those non-agricultural factors are out there influencing the value of the land, the program cannot be implemented. Any other questions? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for missing the opening of your presentation. My question would deal with valuation of farmland under the Green Acres provision. We had a discussion at our local county office with the, I believe it was the auditor, came in and said that our McLeod County valuations are at 110% of the base county acres for Green Acres valuation. Are you familiar with those five base counties in southwestern Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. I'm not sure if you're asking me beyond that.
Well, okay, first I wanted to clarify that I was clear in what I was going to ask. And that is the land valuation in those five southwestern counties have apparently risen with the increasing property values and so forth. And in McLeod County, because we are, you know, just outside the urban area, the metro area, our land values have also increased, such that now our Green Acres valuation on our cropland is nearly the same as the non-Green Acres ag land valuation. Can you explain, do you have any information on why that would be so?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with McLeod County situation. I know that given the proximity to the Twin Cities area, McLeod County's land values certainly are being affected by non-agricultural influences, which would suggest that the agricultural use value should be quite a bit lower than the other value, the market value of the land. So I just don't know enough about what's going on in McLeod County to be able to answer that intelligently, but I guess I'd be surprised that the Green Acres value would be considered to be close to the market value of the land.
The information that we got from our, Madam Chair, may I? Was that the, I believe it was the Department of Revenue, you know, pegged the value for our acres. And if I recall right, the non-Green Acres farmland value is at about $3,350 per acre, and our Green Acres land value is at about $3,300 per acre.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative, I think now I'm following what you're saying. Under the Department's proposal for valuing Green Acres land, I believe what you're saying is that under this proposal, the value that that Green Acres land would receive would be very close to the value of land that's not in the program. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that, Madam Chair, Representative, that can certainly be the case. I don't know enough about the particulars of McLeod County to understand it well enough, but if what I'm thinking is true, it's because the value of the land in McLeod County is at a certain percentage of the land in those five southwestern counties that the department is using as a base then to determine what the Green Acres land value will be in other counties around the state. It may be better, Madam Chair Representative, to ask one of the representatives of the Department of Revenue to talk more about McLeod County, because I just don't have enough information about that to be helpful.
Thank you.
As you know, I've had a lot of frustrations with the Green Acre, and I remember just lately they were in our newspaper. The it I think it was the assessor saying that we are not implementing it yet, and that's so how do we go about that with those of us who have assessors that are doing that? And I know I asked him once, and he said, well, we would lose too many tax property tax dollars.
Well, Madam Chair, under the Department of Revenue's proposal, county assessors would no longer have it as a discretionary option whether or not the program would be implemented. It would be implemented across the state. The extent to which the land values are reduced will vary still,
mm-hmm.
But it would be something that would be available regardless of what the county assessor says. It would certainly become more of a statewide controlled program under the Department of Revenue's proposal.
And I'll ask another question. Did you deal with the water piece with ag? You know, we've talked about blue water in the past and green acres. If you put your farmland into green acres, will they still use that buffer as seasonal rec? That might be something for revenue, though.
Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure that I follow, but if the land meets the other criteria, if it has a minimum of 10 acres, if mm-hmm. the owner meets the ownership requirements mm-hmm. and the income criterion is met, then even if the land is adjacent to lakeshore, it would still qualify. Now, the house garage in 1 acre on land that is homesteaded does not get the reduced value. It's the remaining acreage that does get the reduced value. I'm not sure if that's answering your question.
Right, I think so. In other words, the land near the lake would be ag land and not seasonal rec. I mean, we're having a terrible time with that in our areas.
Madam Chair, if the land is classified as agricultural, yes, it would qualify. Now, that of course, it's up to the assessor to determine what classification is placed on that property. So if the assessor determines that land is not primarily agricultural, if it doesn't meet the classification requirements in statute, then that land would not be eligible for the program. So it has to be, you know, it has to meet those definitional requirements that are in the statute. But as I mentioned earlier, part of the problem we saw with that is that there is inconsistency in how it's interpreted from county to county.
Right, and I think with the water and the ag land, you know, the farmers are still using that as ag land. I think that the assessors are just using that as an opportunity to have higher property taxes, is what we sort of think.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that if there were additional specificity added to the statutes in defining how land could be classified as agricultural, that those kinds of questions would become moot, because that's one of the reasons we think it's important to have additional specificity, so that those kinds of situations can be clear from the get-go for both the assessor and the landowner.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it can vary, because the same similar situation in an adjoining county might be classified mm-hmm. as agricultural, but mm-hmm. in Todd County or some other county could be classified as seasonal rest.
Right, and I see that from Morrison to Todd. And so there are differences, even though they're right next to each other. Are there any other questions or discussions? Anybody else want to come to the table?
Are you asking, Madam Chair, are you asking me to help you?
Yes. Representative Haas, do you want to, as he comes up? You can come to the table.
I just have one question, Madam Chair, and within this, with the classification for what the valuation is per acre under the agricultural setting, are there any recommendations of how to possibly keep up with the fluctuations, especially with higher commodity prices and stuff, that the income generated from from our farm now are different than what they were just a few years ago, and is there a mechanism in which we can keep up to the actual value or valuation of those properties?
Madam Chair and Representative, well, in terms of the Green Acres Program, as I said earlier, the income requirement is such that it hasn't changed at all since the late 1960s. And we're thinking, we concluded that the land should be a part of the Green Acres Program more in terms of how the land is used as opposed to whether or not an income criterion is met. So if our recommendations were implemented, the income that the land produces would no longer be pertinent. But if that land could indeed meet the, a more specific definition of primarily agricultural, then it would qualify for the Green Acres Program. Now, I think that your question has sort of broader implications. That I think you're talking about just in general whether land that has increased in value because of good farming years, you know, how that's reflected in the classification of the land and also the setting of the value. Now, we didn't get into that in this particular study, so I can't address that piece of your question.
Okay, thank you. Would you state your name?
Yes, my name's Leo Poole. I live in Hamilton County in the suburbs of Independence. And just for the record, I'd like to correct one thing. Is it Ms. Hoyer? Just like to correct one thing that she said, that that people can divide their land and sell it off if they want to. We can't. We're in 1 in 50 in Independence. So we can't do that. Now I own a 13-acre hobby farm, but I do farm it. I just want to make that statement that that land is not necessarily allowed to be divided depending on what city you live in, what county you live in. I don't believe the system's broken. I believe all you need to do, I think this is just a waste of taxpayers' money. If you just had in the early 1980s, the taxation department must have got together with some of the legislators, and they threw a word into this Green Acres statute, and the word was primarily, that farm had to be primarily agricultural. That's what this whole hullabaloo is about, the Medina case, where two doctors had a farm, bought some farmland, 20 acres, built a million-dollar mansion in the middle, put some grass and some landscaping around it, put a swimming pool at the back, and got another farmer down the road to come and cut 15 acres and decided to apply for Green Acres. Well, that was what was referred to as a Medina case. Well, they took these Green Acres away. And my argument, whether you live in Hamilton County or no matter what county you live in the state, my argument is if you want to farm it, there's no difference between my alfalfa or my 8 acres that I produce or my 13 acres. There's no difference in my bale of alfalfa than the bale of alfalfa that's coming off 100 or 200 acres somewhere else within the state. It still feeds America. That's what this whole thing is all about, keeping small farmers farming, keeping the little guys farming. The mission statement of the Metropolitan Council is to keep open spaces. The mission statement of the City of Independence is that the majority of people, when they had a referendum, they wanted to keep small farms. They wanted to go to church on Sunday morning and see the sheep and the cows grazing as they went to church. They love that. And that's great. If you want it, and we can't divide our land up, they won't allow us out there. If you want that atmosphere, if you still want that in the 7-county metropolitan area, you've got to give the little farmer a break. You want to keep him farming, you've got to give it to him. And whether you live in northwestern Minnesota or southwestern Minnesota or southeastern Minnesota or northeastern Minnesota, it should be the same policy for all farmers. And it should be the same criteria. The criteria was one third of the income had to come off the farm and or $300 per farm plus $10 per tillable acre. If you went back to that, there wouldn't be a discussion here. And you could say to the people that had acreage, you want a farm? Okay, if you want a farm, here's your tax base. Well, no matter where you live in Minnesota, here's your tax base, that's what you got to pay for Green Acres. Mm-hmm. And forget the values, and forget the taxation, and forget the amount of money that the state's missing out on. The whole idea is to keep farmers farming. And if I can just make one other statement, The word killable should be thrown out of the statute because it's not killable anymore. There's many, many forms of farming that's come in now. There's sustainable farming. Mm-hmm. There's organic farming. There's raising of wine, of grapes for wine. It's just not killable. Killable is row crops. So when they use the word killable, and the assessor comes out to my place, he doesn't see me with my tractor and my plough ploughing to plant soybeans or corn. He says, "Well, you're not a farm." I said, "Well, I've got acreage." He says, "You don't meet the criteria. You don't have 10. I've got 13 acres, but you don't have 10 acres of killable." But there's other types of farming now. There's many types, like my apiary, my bees. I can't lift up the top of the beehive and tell the bees, "Today, guys, all you got to do is go over to where the alfalfa is. You can't go to the trees, my boxwood trees, and get the pollen off those trees in the spring. You can't go all over my farm and get the pollen off the wildflowers that grow." This can be really remedied very, very easy. Go back to the old system, one-third of the income comes off the farm, and or $300 plus $10 per kilowatt acre. The argument's all over. It's quite simple. And you know what? If any of you people want to know what's really happening, talk to us, all farmers. If you've got any questions, don't go to the taxation department. They're just interested in screwing the little farmer to the hilt. Don't go to the Department of Agriculture, because they're in bed with the taxation department. Come to us little guys and ask what's really happening. And we can tell you. But if you want to keep farming in the 7-county metropolitan area, help us keep the green acres going. But if you don't want to drive around and see open spaces, raise our taxes and push us off the land.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our hope, that across the state we can be the same. So, Representative Junkie?
Yeah. Myself?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move House File 3392, and I believe we refer to the Committee on Commerce.
Representative Johnson.
Then I got an author's amendment to move first. There was a drafting error in the title. So line 1.2, delete "to sell product at farmers," and then 1.3, delete "markets and." So it will read, "allowing farm wineries to manufacture," et cetera, et cetera. That corrects the title.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
And Madam Chair, members, this is just a simple bill. It allows cognac to be manufactured at our farm wineries. That will have to be licensed. They can only manufacture up to the same gallonage that they've always been able to under their farm winery license. And no one that I know of is against this. Came from a winery in my area, but I've since heard from wineries all over the state, and it just adds more product that they can sell. The retail liquor folks are for it because it's more Minnesota products they can put on their shelves, and so they're happy to help us out with this.
Are there any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, this is the Ag Committee, and typically we have samples.
Unfortunately, we can't make it yet to represent Hamilton, so as soon as we can, I assume we'll make some of our Szymanski apples, and then he'll be making that maybe out on his own farm winery and bring some in.
Representative Szymanski.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. Representative Junkie, we'll get to the apple cognac one of these days. My question is, this bill, would this have any complications with federal regulations, ATF and so forth?
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, not that I'm aware of. The House researcher sitting behind you is shaking his head no. Mr. McCormick is our expert, by the way, and he's here. He does all the liquor law guruing upstairs.
Any other? Okay. Representative Piskowski.
Madam Chair of Committee and Representative, the
The $500 fee to the commissioner, is there, could you explain that?
Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, no, I can't. I just picked it out. If you're doing 5,000 gallons, that would be a dime a gallon would be your fee to do it. So those that are going to do it, it'll be a good profit center for them. But that's why we're going over to Commerce to understand what it will pay. Really, the fee is for inspections and monitoring of this, just like with the farm winery. So we know it has to be something, and I suspect over in Commerce they'll have a better idea of what those costs may be. But we plugged in 500 for now, thinking a dime a gallon is probably reasonable.
Any other questions or discussion? If not,
I'd renew my motion that House File 3392, as amended, be recommended and passed and sent to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And Representative Haas, would you like to move the minutes from February 27th?
I'd be more than happy to, Madam Chair.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passed. Yes. Turn.